Welcome to Extroverted Develop. I'm Jim Wallace.
I'm Ben Gunderson.
And we're here with special guest today,
Jonathan Baker.
Hey, John.
Hey, John.
How are you?
I'm doing okay for a Monday that's gotten a little chilly. DC has gotten a little colder than it was over the last month or so. We had a March in the 80s, and now we're in April in the 60s. So.
Oh, sad. And you're out in D.C. because you're out here with Sybase?
Yeah, I work for SAP now. Sybase was acquired by SAP about a year and a half ago. So we're in the process of the long, drawn-out process of being integrated into a new, bigger company.
That's great. So why was SAP interested in Sybase? Sybase is a database technology, right?
Well, it's interesting. Sybase started as a database technology company, and then it branched out to do a number of different things. Like most big software companies, it started getting into new fields. And one of the fields it got into was mobile databases and small footprint database platforms. And
so like in-memory databases?
There's a difference. I mean, there's databases come in multiple flavors. There's the big, huge monster databases that Wall Street uses for all of its trades. You know,
they just use Oracle.
Yeah. Actually, most of them use Sybase. Yeah. I mean, the Sybase main database is kind of like a Ferrari. It really does crank through a lot of huge transactions in a hurry.
And that's a relational database?
It is.
A standard.
Relations, okay. Yeah. So then there's a smaller footprint database we had that was supposed to be, didn't require 14 people to keep it running all the time.
What's the fun of that?
That you don't need. You can install it on a laptop and not pay attention to it for 6 months.
Okay, and that's more for developers, or
yeah. Well, it's for deployment out to say like a cash registers in some store that you can't maintain every day. So, and that database eventually turned into a ultralight footprint database that can actually live on a mobile device. So they have one now that is a full database engine. It's a relational database that lives on like an iPhone or an iPad or, you know, or an Android device or like about a dozen other choices. So
that's awesome.
Yep. And so that database, and then there's an in-memory database, which is what a lot of companies use when they have a lot, you know, that want to make things faster for doing reporting and stuff, which is something separate as well.
Oh, interesting. And I guess the table layout or something is different in there? Like use a column?
For memory database? No, it's about the same. I mean, the difference on an in-memory database is that you don't you use it for reporting, but you don't use it to
store a gigabyte worth of stuff.
Well, you don't store anything you care about, because if the power goes out, then all the memory goes poof,
right?
And all that data goes, you know, vanishes. So, you know, you use it for like reporting on trades, but when you want to record a trade, you're still using that physical media.
Okay, and what is your exact job there?
I am the director for mobility evangelism.
Oh, that's awesome. Mm-hmm. And that's why you know all about this ultra-lightweight mobility database. Okay. And then SAP grabbed you guys up probably for your mobile product.
They wanted mobility out of us, and then they've actually just recently decided that they're going to make a play on Oracle as well. So they've carved our company into component pieces. Mobility was one of the big reasons they first picked us up, and now they're taking the ASE line directly to Oracle, which brings them into parity, because Oracle's had financials for a long time, and now SAP has a database, so they can now compete head to head.
That's great. Is there any talk of I don't know if you can comment on this. Is there any talk of SAP moving away from Oracle? I know the most common integration is SAP with Oracle.
Yes, there actually was a conference call with analysts and everybody else, actually external people, less than a month ago, where they announced their plans to bring the database wing as a full-on competitor to Oracle. And they are in the process of announcing plans right now to bring ways for their customers to migrate off of Oracle databases onto the new Sybase SAP database.
Okay, and so that's a task for your engineers to make that as seamless as possible.
Yeah, well, yeah, more along the lines of lots of consultants.
Oh, okay, yeah, cool. Well, that's fun, and we can continue talking about Sybase, which is a very interesting technology. But I'm curious, you're a very accomplished software engineer, and you were there for a long, long time. What made you decide to move into the mobility evangelism space as opposed to... Do you still get to code, I guess, is what I'm asking?
Well, yeah, I actually do a lot of coding, and I have a lot of fun with it, and that's kind of why I stayed in mobility, because, you know, it's interesting. I mean, I started with the company when they were getting into the heyday of doing a lot of Java work with application servers. So I started as an application guy, and then I got pulled back across for a while to do database work, because that's was still the company's biggest focus. And then I think the first chance they gave me to kind of go back to development, I said, yeah, there's lots of database people here, and it's their specialty, but it's not really what I'm here to do. And I'm not as you know, I'm not as excited about it as these other guys. So let's move on. Let's move back to where I started.
So you work mostly, I would guess that there's sort of two spaces. There's the system space, which is the database stuff that you're talking about.
Right.
And then the application space, which is you use this system to build great applications. Is that more of what you're doing?
Right. Well, and that, yes, exactly. And that's the interesting part that I brought to it is that, you know, companies will tell you about the fact that they need to get data to these mobile platforms, but the data is useless without the application to sit on top of it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, building applications on mobile devices is something that a lot of companies are really just kind of sticking their toe in the water now to try to do. And so even though there's a lot of developers out there that are developing for iPhones and iPads and other mobile platforms.
Mm-hmm. For the consumer market.
Oh, yeah, exactly. The corporate environment has been slow to pick it up. And now they're trying to figure out, well, how do we play in this space and how do we work in it? And unlike the consumer market, these guys carry a lot of data with them. You know, like they want to make sure all their information is synchronized with their back end, that they don't lose anything, they're going to remove anything. So we start with how do you get the information out of those silos that are in your company out to the device, and then how do we put a bunch of stuff on top of it and how to make it work. And a lot of this is basically just educating them on what it's like to be working in the mobile space and to get used to these guys, you know, all these fun guys who are developing mobile applications now, and not just look at them as scary people, but as people who are really going to help them, you know, move mm-hmm. forward.
In the mobile space, do you have a favorite platform? You've mentioned iPhone, but it seems like they don't play very well with enterprise level customers.
Well, actually, I think they do.
You do?
They do a lot more now than they used to. You know, it's really interesting. I've had a love of Apple because I think that by breaking into the space, these guys have pioneered lots of new things. I mean, I bought an iPhone about 4 weeks after they came out, mm-hmm. and I bought an iPad only a couple months after they came out. And in both cases, you know, they've proven that they can blow open a space and show you how they can provide a platform that you can use to develop applications and take stuff where it's never been before.
Mm-hmm.
I'm also a big fan of Android, and you know, I've been watching Microsoft rather closely to see if they're going to come up and be in that number third spot. And I think they're going to do pretty well. And that's good because they should be competing with these companies should be competing. It forces them to always innovate and always move forward. But you know, there's a soft spot for the guy who basically figured out how to do it first. And
sure,
you know, you can look back in the history of mobility and say, look, Microsoft tried multiple times to bring out a tablet.
Windows CE.
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah, drop Windows onto a tablet, and it wasn't really that great.
That's actually Bill's fault.
Yeah.
There's a great story inside Microsoft about how that came about. When the Palm Pilot was big, a couple of smart kids interned at Microsoft, and they wanted to create a mobile operating system for Microsoft to compete in the Palm Pilot space. And they had a whole prototype working. They built it in a single summer. They spec'd it all out. They had it running on a device, and they go and present it to Bill Gates at the end of the summer, and it's like a big to-do. And he takes one look at it and goes, where's HWIN, and throws it back at them. because he wanted coding for the mobile to be the same as coding for the desktop, but clearly it can't be, because the resource constraints and the visual constraints and the input constraints are very different from that of a full-fledged computer program,
right?
A full-fledged PC.
And I think that's
at least they were at the time, right? I mean, now Apple is about to dump OS X and switch entirely to, I think in 2 years, MacBooks are going to be running iOS.
I think so, too. But I think that's because it's easier to go from a limited resource system up to a fuller resource system with a full keyboard and mouse and everything than it is to go the other way.
You know, I don't know. I mean, I look at those, you know, one-size-fits-all operating systems, and mm-hmm. I always find myself a little bit hesitant to jump on that bandwagon. It's been tried before multiple times, and it's a really very, very delicate task to thread that needle and to get an operating system that would run both the Mac and the devices, you know, and the touchscreen devices, and that, you know, kind of can interoperate between different input systems and different ways of accepting data and different form factors. You know, I don't know.
Smartphones haven't really been full-fledged computing devices until very recently as well. So there's not even a lot of data to show one way or the other until the last year even.
And I think that's, you know, that's definitely what Microsoft is betting the house on with Metro. I mean, they're saying, you know, we're going to be able to write applications that will run on PCs and run on these smartphone devices, and you'll be able to run back and forth. And they might be able to pull it off, but there's really two questions. One, is that going to create a bloated operating system?
Right.
And two, will the developers really be qualified to be able to work in this multi-space environment and create applications that are that flexible? I think there'll be a small subset of developers that can handle it, but a lot of the developers, I think, will find that they'll struggle in that space, because that's going to be graduate level material right there. That's not going to be trivial.
I feel like the merging of mobile and desktop computing has actually been the greatest boon to user interface design, because when you have to start with a small form factor and work your way up, you tend to think simpler. I think Metro has been, granted, I haven't gotten to use Metro much outside of Windows Phone devices, but I think the fact that they started with this idea of the tiles and of this really kind of simplistic color and icon based design is going to reap huge benefits. When you're presented with all this screen real estate, sometimes you're tempted to overload it with a lot more than is really necessary. I mean, I think if you look at your parents' desktop and the icon, hundreds of icons scattered across it, you can see that in some ways the Microsoft's desktop motif kind of failed in that way, right? People tend to just sort of dump things wherever they can see them, and Metro sort of solved this by presenting an app like interface where you can only have maybe 10, 12 different things on the screen at a time, and you switch, swipe back and forth from screen to screen. It just makes everything so much simpler when you start off with the assumption that what you can pay attention to is limited.
I completely agree. And this actually brings me to one of those religious points I get onto with software all the time, which is that I find that organizations I'm working with have spent a lot of time thinking about information and spend far too little time thinking about user interface design and usability. And, I'm hoping that you're right, which is that the mobile platforms and that things like Metro will push these developers into starting to think about how usability really does make a difference in these applications. Because I've seen a lot of corporate applications that tend to I agree with you. They tend to use this real estate, and what they do is they splatter fields all over the screen, and they wrap
especially in finance.
Oh, it's awful! And then they wrap boxes around it and say, "Oh, see, we categorized things." No, you didn't. There's still 400 fields, and you're using exactly six of them. And what are the rest of them doing blank?
Those are just in case.
Yeah, exactly right. in case anyone never uses them again, I think that would help us to really push forward this idea that we need to do a better job of user interface design. And I mean, again, and I'm probably being prejudiced about Apple, but I'm glad Apple really got to be in front, because their religious belief in user interface needs to look good has set the bar really high. And so I think now the problem is that these corporate developers, can't just slap out an interface and go, "You'll use it," because their users already have a much higher expectation. And I've actually seen that in a couple cases with companies that are frustrated about their initial efforts, because they've gone ahead and they've done all the back work, and then they just slap together a very, very 20-second build user interface, mm-hmm. and said, "Why don't they like it?" And I'm like, "Well, because they're used to fantastic and you gave them bad."
Yeah, every computer science person that I've talked to, I can't say every. Whenever you make sweeping generalizations, you tend to be incorrect. But most computer science people, hardcore algorithms, data structures, like you're probably the systems people at your thing that are really into the database, mm-hmm. they just could care less about the UI, and they are like, "Oh, yeah, but the UI is easy. You just slap it on at the end."
Right.
It wasn't until, and I agree with you, it wasn't until 2006 when Apple came out with the iPhone that people really started to take a look at how user experience can sell the functionality. It's not enough to be technically excellent, right? You need both. And this has started a revolution in software where I see people hiring designers as part of software teams,
which they should have been doing the whole time.
They should have.
Yeah, and now they're paying the price for not doing it, because their thought was, well, we did all the back end, who cares what it looks like? And yet now they're realizing, well, what it looks like is 90% of the work. I mean, but you bring up an interesting point. Another place that we found, and this is something from inside Sybase, a database company, I've seen far too much of, which is a lot of our developers are now living in this world where they're either developers or they're DBAs. And I get really frustrated with anyone who tells me that there's some massive distinction between I'm a front-end guy and I'm a data guy. Because I've seen great systems that are being built on the cheapest piece of data storage technology they can lay their hands on, and it's awful. And then I've seen awful front ends built with spectacular database systems. And, you know, I think that what most people need to realize is that you can't do that anymore. You've got to have both. And this idea that...
In one developer or both on a team?
I think developers can stretch themselves into understanding enough about the other person's space that they can find a way to work together. I mean,
both points of view have to be represented, whether it's in a single person or in a team. Some understanding has to be present.
Yes, and I agree. And I think that the specialization and expertise is great. But what I find interesting is this, that's their problem, not my problem mentality that tends to permeate this data design versus front-end design decisions. And I think that that's bogus. I mean, if you're a developer that's developing front ends and you can't write a line of SQL, at least a basic line of select or update SQL,
oh, sure.
You shouldn't be developing, because that basic understanding of that data transaction layer is important to understand, because it's how you bring information to yourself. And trying to pretend that that is not your problem is just digging us deeper and deeper back into another hole. I mean, congratulations, you've managed to do one thing spectacularly well and dig a huge pit on the other side.
Yeah, in general, I can't really stand people who have the "it's not my problem" attitude. I think that we're always told in companies that, oh, we're all in it together, we're all on the same team. But there's always that like problem when you run into the departments, right? Like, oh, that guy works on that department, and thus we can't either interact with him, we can't spend time solving his problems when we have our own problems. And I hate it. I wish we could get through that. Do you have any suggestions, Don?
I think that for the most part, I mean, you know, this comes down to those basic not to get into the graduate level classes or the university mentality, but but really, I mean, there are some basic design philosophies that developers need to follow on a regular basis. And, you know, the classic stuff we talk about all the time, the model view controller philosophies, the data isolation, the having independent architecture layers that allow you to modify one thing without having to break everything else.
I can't even get them to stop using singletons.
Yeah.
No, I'm serious. Like, I can't.
Yeah. And this stuff is really important. And I think that, you know, one of the benefits of the mobile platform, just to bring this full circle, is that that limited design space and that limited footprint and that limited memory causes you to have to think again about, I can't just slap this together and then, you know, hope that it works and then make it really fragile. I actually have to make this kind of work out there. It also, by the way, says these devices are operating in the wild, and you can't just assume, well, some IT guy will just, virtually shell into your system and take a look at it. I think that anybody who thinks that that's how you solve problems on these devices and that's how you troubleshoot software is going to get a real wake-up call.
So you're saying no more live debugger to production trying to catch that bug?
No more IT, hey, just, you know, get on that person's computer and test it yourself remotely type of thing. I think that if you don't have some type of interactive data collection system telling you when things go wrong on the device, you, again, are going to get caught looking the wrong way. And so I think it's a big push for the developers to it's going to push them to be doing things they should have been doing for years and they could have done for years, and now they actually have to do.
Yeah, I don't know if Apple offers these built in, but Microsoft does. They're called Squim and Watson, and they've come with the operating system forever. So one advantage of using the Windows 7 architecture as the base for Windows 8 means you get these technologies as well when you go to the tablet.
Right, but I mean, anytime an application asks you, "Hey, can I send usage statistics and can I send crash reports back to my host because I want to find out what happened when something blew up in your face?"
Yeah,
I mean, the answer to that is that's a person who's thinking about trying to solve problems without having to like actually be looking over your shoulder while they're doing it. And I have a little bit more hope of that. And I think in mobility, that's now going to be a requirement. I mean, you can't just expect these devices are going to be there.
Yeah,
the one thing that we find. And not to change the subject too much, but I was reminded of one thing in data that we are running into right now, which is the title of my blog, which is Ubiquitous Mobility. And I drew that title from the fact that the mobile sector is currently going through a wave that looks a lot like the one that we went through with the internet, where we had a bunch of devices that were connected sometimes or not connected at all or had to be run independently, and then we had these proprietary wiring schemes, almost like these little Wi-Fi hotspots that would come along. And now what we're seeing is these devices are more and more constantly accessible to the internet, but they're not quite there yet. So we're still running into this like this problem where we're developing applications that are, you know, do I pull the data to the device and store it locally? Do I just basically reach out to my server on the back end, and mm-hmm. you know, do I do all that work? And I think that that's going to be a real challenge for the developer now, is that, you know, in the world of desktop development, the internet's always on. In the world of mobility, it's not always there. There, you know, when you get on the airplane, the internet
right,
goes
but
away.
It's tempting so. To think that it is.
Yes, yeah, it is. But I also think that it's also a mistake to think that your users would be happy to live with 5 months, you know, with 5 hour old data constantly. Like, you can't just have a nightly batch refresh of information. You've got to somehow figure out how to balance that tightrope of keeping your data refreshed and yet not like completely hanging your user out to dry when they're suddenly dropped off the net because the great AT&T signal just went away. So,
yeah, and more often we're finding that that's the case for desktop applications as well. Users are demanding web applications that don't, you know, just present you with a loading bar when suddenly your internet connection drops. I mean, Gmail works in offline mode now. I mean, you have to be able to present at least a something of a user interface, some method of usability, an outbox, if you will, that where you can store things that you're doing offline and wait for the internet connection to come back.
Yep. And I think, you know, like in HTML5 with its brand new ability to store information on the browser, I think it's time for the developers to start thinking about how they're caching information and keeping some type of either back-end synchronization or the most intelligent thing I've seen is the tool sets now that will tell you, hey, you know, I'll run in the background as a thread and I will tell you what your current network state is and announce whenever that network state is shifted back and forth, so that you can be dynamically taking action based on I'm on, I'm off, I'm on, I'm off, and never really, you know, drop out. You can say, okay, well, I'm off. I'll have to work in one mode. Okay, I'm back. I'll go back to working another mode. Okay, I'm off again. I'll try again.
Yeah, it makes sense.
I think that
the funny thing is that these limitations are actually forcing people to be better programmers, or at least follow better patterns, because you really should be working that way anyway, right? Like, you can't assume an always on mentality.
Yeah.
I feel like it's creating better habits, just as forcing yourself to deal with smaller screen real estate or smaller attention spans, or creating better habits in UX as well.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the themes that being the database company that became a mobility company, we've really tried to kind of point out to people, is to say, okay, it's time for you to start getting into this idea that, you know, your data may or may not be available, and you need to be thinking about these things that before were always easy, or that, you know, were always a quick shortcut of, well, I only want to work in one particular mode. So.
Mm-hmm. On that, you actually have some very interesting ideas about software as a profession and about sort of raising the bar of our professionalism, like getting accreditation or having a license, like the bar, where they could pull your license if you don't do these things, like, oh, make sure that it works in offline and offline mode, or if you, like, say you're writing medical device software and you literally kill somebody, or there was this famous case of software gone haywire in Seattle where an X-ray machine was giving too much radiation due to a bug in software, and everybody who got X-rayed by that machine has a specific genetic defect that they can track through the generations.
Right.
Now, because of software problems.
Right. Well, I mean, you know, this is an interesting. So there are a bunch of blogs that are coming out of some of the computer science and technology departments at different universities. And there are some of my favorites come out of places like Stanford and Berkeley.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, what they talk about is the fact that our industry is so young and so new that a lot of people have gotten into this industry. And there's a lot of people working in it right now, but there isn't really a good sense of how this industry should run itself, right? It's kind of still the wild west of a big industry.
Mm-hmm.
So we have lots of people who basically tack the word software developer onto their title, go out and apply.
No,
for
we're
a
all
job.
Software engineers,
right? You know, pick something that says software and add another, you know, add 25% to your base salary, and suddenly you're a software person. And I think that, you know, for a lot of people, you know, that's helped them get jobs and keep jobs and find new things to do. But it's also created this very murky environment of if, especially if you're in management, of what is the difference between a, you know, just a person who can crank out a little bit of code versus an actual real honest to God software engineer. And what am I looking for, and why do I need the difference? And I think that, you know, their point is pretty interesting, which is that, you know, just like in medicine and a number of other fields, as these fields got more complicated and as they grew up, they started finding they had to have, you know, accreditation systems and testing and procedures for licensing and everything else to come along, because otherwise there was just too much damage that could be done. And there's too much liability, it's, you know, that goes into place.
Mm-hmm.
We're seeing that right now. I mean, we're seeing that the liability things you just pointed out, I think, are the tip of a very large iceberg that'll become bigger and bigger. And the
luckily, we all signed end-user license agreements that wash all the liability away from.
Yeah, you wish. Yeah, until somebody with a lot of money and you know, or until some, you know, 6-year-old kid who really looks great sits in front of a jury box and says, "Why me?" And mm-hmm. the jury suddenly decides that all of that end-user shrink-wrap licensing is so much junk and they can throw it away because the kid shouldn't have been hurt.
Right.
You know, I think that those liability concerns are real, and I think that we're going to get – that's going to push us in a direction. But, you know, more to the point, I think that the idea that somebody can just pick up a book, spend a couple weekends learning about how to write Visual Basic, and then go ahead and become – and call themselves a software engineer is really almost disastrous, because they can code, but – I think the coding that they provide is very fragile. I think it's very naive. I think it tends to be very much more bug prone. And I think that, you know, there is always going to be that exception, that
sure.
one person who literally just is a savant who can pick it up on the fly. But for the most part,
Patch Adams.
Yeah, exactly. You're getting what you paid for. And I think organizations need to realize that they need to find a way to get the to weed out the better people and to find the people who are, you know, in medical terms, board certified to do this or to do that, so that they can say to somebody, "Are you a real honest to God interactive web design developer? Can you actually write? Are you, you know, do you comprehend the languages necessary to do this, and can you make this all work?"
Mm-hmm. I think you're going to get pushback on that from the people who think that computer programmers can learn anything and can do anything. I definitely had that attitude for a long time. I know many other developers that do, who are like, "No, it doesn't matter, because I learned how to code in C, thus I could learn Java, right? I could learn some other things, and I could do that."
Well, many
companies have tried this, right? MCSE, MCSD, the Cisco certified stuff. I mean, even right. mm-hmm. A+ certification, as much of a joke as that is, I mean,
but even farther than that, the IEEE and the ACM are like larger standard bodies that have tried to do it as well.
And not
just MCSE is just Microsoft.
And
right?
they found that the body moves so fast that they can't really do it. But I mean, hey, medical knowledge moves very fast, and yet they still manage to accomplish it. It's not an impossible task to do this. The mm-hmm. real problem you have now is that
medical software technology doesn't, but yeah.
yeah. I think it's important for us to not get stuck on that, "Well, it can't be done here because we're something special." I mean, mm-hmm. that's just not true. I mean,
yeah.
we are just like any other major profession. I mean, it's time for us to recognize a few base facts.
Yeah, I think doctors are intelligent people, and they probably think that they could learn anything, but your wife specializes in lady bits, right? And
I think she'd find that amusing as well. Hey, I've met a few doctors who are like, "Oh yes, I can write software," and I'm like, "Oh yeah, I'm sure you can."
You've really met doctors who can write software?
I've met a few who tell me they write software, and I'm like, "And I perform surgery on weekends, but that's okay." And then they just stare at me like, "Are you insane?" And I'm like, "Well, you're writing software." And mm-hmm. to them, they're like, "Well, there's no harm in writing software." And then I want to point them to these medical liability cases and go, "You wish."
Sure.
You know, I think that there's a point in which we're going to need to be more serious about our own field,
mm-hmm.
and so that other people will be more serious about our field as well. And, you know,
and understand estimates. Like, when we give estimates for software projects, not have them push back and cut it in half, because we're like, "No, we're certified. This is what it takes to do this."
Right, but isn't that an entire field of itself? I mean, you know, mm-hmm. like to create the people who can look through software projects and say, "I can give you estimates and give you an understanding of the risks of not understanding what you're trying to develop versus the rewards of, this will cost you a lot less, but I mean, your knowledge is less than you need, or you don't have enough information. So sure, we'll do the work, but you won't get what you want out of it, or it'll be a lot more expensive. You know, look.
Ultimately, it comes down to hiring, right?
Yeah.
If you know when to hire someone or not, if you can judge whether or not someone is worthy of employment, like you can't just walk into a hospital and say, "Hey, I'm a surgeon, you know, hire me."
Yeah, and yet you can for a computer programmer.
I think that's part of the problem, right? Yeah, I mean, if it's almost as if there were hospitals in the very rural areas that if you walked in and said, "I'm a surgeon," they wouldn't even look at you and go and ask you where you went to school. They'd say, "Do you know which end of a knife is which? Okay, you must be fine." That can't continue. And come on. I mean, at some point we also have to blame the management of the companies that are hiring software people and say, your own incompetence has led you to this problem. I mean, you spend a lot of money fixing problems you shouldn't have because you haven't bothered to read The Mythical Man Month. And we should be laughing at you the entire time for saying, well, so 9 people can have a baby in a month, can't they? No, they really can't. And
Dr. Bubba could come into town in his wagon and say, this is my famous snake oil that heals all your wounds, and people would buy it. And I feel like that's where we are right now.
Right, exactly. And that's
everybody comes out with a framework that's supposed to solve all our problems, Ruby on Rails.
Right, I know. But that's exactly what those bloggers are pointing out, is that they're saying, look, there was a time when anybody could basically say, oh, I'm a pharmacist and a doctor and a couple other things, and just ride in there in their wagon. Not so much anymore, but that required time and organization and a lot of other things to take effect. And so their opinion is that this is going to happen. This will happen to the field whether we like it or not. The question is, are we going to wait for it to occur organically, or are we going to kind of give it a – start nudging it forward and saying, hey, we recognize that we will be like these other professions. Now we need to just start pushing ourselves in that direction. And you know what? There's going to be a lot of resistance from the people who are the one language, you know, experts, who will be terrified that they will suddenly find themselves on the bottom of those tiers, and they won't be – their title will change. And yeah, that's going to happen, but that's – that's what happens when you set up certification processes, and that's what happens when these things occur, is that suddenly there is the difference between, you know, the rocket scientist expert and the guy who can do one thing.
Mm-hmm.
I feel bad for those people. I mean, I'm not trying to take their jobs away. What I'm pointing out is that companies should be cognizant of the fact that 10 of those guys are not saving you money. You may think they are because they don't cost you a lot of money to pay, but you're spending so much fixing bugs and in lost productivity time on the software you just developed that you're basically paying the same price.
I don't understand how they don't see the problem from day to day when it takes a day for communication to happen, right?
Yeah.
As opposed to having people who are onshore.
The offshore thing is hilarious because there's a lot of material that says now that although we've created a lot of – and there are a lot of very talented programmers in India that could get the job done – but there's also a lot of, we hired 10 people to do one person's job, and they're not as fast as the one person. We're kind of relearning what we learned in the 1960s about software development with the IBM 370. And guys, I mean, I'm sorry, this isn't rocket science anymore. So I think there are things we can do better, but I think that one of the things that the really smart companies like Google and other really, really bright companies, Facebook, Google, a couple of the other big players, have figured out is that when you bring a few really smart people together and bring them in teams of 3 to 5, they get a lot done. And the big companies are trying to do the same thing with just loads of bodies and are wondering why it's just not happening.
So you think
the mature software companies are starting to have it figured out. I mean, as much as social media bitches about Google's hiring panels and things, I mean, they are taking it seriously, right? That doesn't mean they get it right every time, but they're taking it seriously.
And yes.
They're taking software seriously.
Yep, and when you go to visit their programmers, you begin to realize that they take it seriously inside the company as well. So, you know, but what that means is that Microsoft, Google, Facebook, and a handful of others have really picked out the cream of the crop and left you whatever's left. If I was a big company and I was looking at having my own internal software department, I'd be pissed as hell that I had been locked out of the best of the best developers because these guys had figured out the formula while I was wandering around with a blindfold on.
And formula is not that hard.
Yeah.
Pay more.
Well,
but
no,
a lot, the,
no,
the
pay
sad
more.
Thing is a lot of the companies that really need this talent are not small companies, right? They're the Procter and Gambles the big, big companies of the world. ExxonMobil and these companies that need software more than almost anything else, or at least they're starting to realize that. And Google and Microsoft and Facebook have taken that talent.
And you know what? Paying more doesn't always necessarily get to the best.
Well, I
talent.
Say that because one of the things that Wall Street was famous for doing, I guess, in the late 90s and early 2000s, is they would let people go through the Microsoft interview, like a college student. I'm a college student. I'm about to graduate. I go through the Microsoft interview. I go through the Google interview. I get offers from both. Then Goldman Sachs comes in and doubles it.
Right.
Right. They let Microsoft and Google filter their out candidates. The people,
and then they basically go, look, double money. And then you come work for them. And you know what? If that's their solution, I'm glad that they found a way to basically, you know, filter out the best graduates and find a solution by throwing money at the problem.
I think that's all they have.
Yeah.
We call that the New York Yankees method.
Yeah, I like that.
I prefer the Oakland A's method, which is to use statistics to basically cream your opponents and then have them wondering why it is that you're basically beating the crap out of them. Not because you are beating the crap out of them, but because you realize that the goal is to win. This to get to the playoffs and not to look like you're paying more money than anyone.
Right, and the goal of software is to make functional software with as few bugs as possible. Right,
exactly. So, I mean,
you don't have to make the best software in the world to win. You have to make good software.
Right, and I think that, but you know what? In 10 years ago, you could make software by being either one of the big companies where you were the only player, or by being one of the few people who could get published and get your CDs printed. Now we're in an online virtual economy where, I'll tell you what, if your app in the App Store is not better than everybody else's app in the App Store, you are buried and done. And so, you know, there is really
a five-star rating.
Yeah, well, but the Darwinian effect is taking hold, which is saying, hey, look, good software is not enough anymore. If you are going to play in this space, you got to be better than good. And I take that back to what I've learned in evangelism, which is you go to companies and they come back and say, why is my app not working? Why won't anybody accept it? And I'm like, because the bar's been set higher, guys. It's no longer just use our app because we told you to. Mm-hmm. You wrote your own internal expense reporting app and people hate it because there are five excellent players in the market that have spectacular apps and everybody's seen them. So guess what? Either get on game or, even better, hire somebody who is, and you know, like, go find the good software. And I think that's good for our industry because it means that it is driving the good developers to be better, and it's now showing you where they are.
That's
this
true.
Is what happened to Sony, ahead, right? Like, Sony became rich in a time when all you had to do was get something that people hadn't seen on the market, and you know, and you made $1 billion and. It's not that easy anymore.
Yes, unfortunately, this was Microsoft's flaw at one point, was to think we're so big nobody can beat us, and you know, not to realize that yes, you can beat you. All you have to do is be another company willing to take a big risk on a small iPhone or a small phone platform, and basically wake up one morning and realize you are in deep trouble. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, like, you may be big, but you're now in enormous trouble. And again, it's that great software with a great platform suddenly becomes the winning solution to something you've tried to do five or six times with a good platform and lousy software. No wonder yours didn't work, but when the two bind together, wow. You know, I mean, we're talking about one of the biggest capitalized companies on the planet. It's not a... This again, it's like, who do I have to explain this to? I mean, yeah, you know, no, like, well, everyone at Wall Street gets it, right?
Yeah, you were taking you're upset at Microsoft and Google for taking the best talent, but there is something to be said for the App Store taking talent as well, because constantly I'm hearing complaints like, why can't we find good app developers that will take $40,000 a year, right? And I'm like, because they can put their own app in the market and get $100,000 a year,
right?
Like, you're also competing with the App Store for developer talent.
Right, but if you think about it, if you take one of those App Store or three or four of those App Store people and turn them into talent at your own company, you know, if you just were to look at it long game instead of just what am I paying my software developers and my expense line item, and change it into what's my productivity gains overall, and I suddenly am looking at 7 and 8 figures and not 6 figures, all of a sudden this numbers make sense.
Right, because a team of these guys could build much more value than they would do on their own.
And you know what is fascinating? And our sales guys love to trumpet this, which is they say, you know, if you don't get on the mobile platform space, you will be left behind.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, that's a great way for SAP to sell software. But it's also true. I mean, if your company thinks that they can sit still and let everybody else grab mobile space in front of them, they will wake up one day and realize that I don't care who they are and what they're making, they can be left behind. If a titan of industry can be pushed aside by another titan of industry's technological prowess, I don't whatever widget you're making, somebody can figure out how to do it better.
Sure.
I was just looking at I'm in love with an app called Uber. Have you heard of Uber?
Yeah, Uber is the illegal taxi app.
The illegal taxi app, right?
Or in DC.
Yeah, I know you're talking about.
And by the way, the taxi people, it's driving them insane. Well, congratulations, guys. Technology is about to drive you off the deep edge. And
what I love about Uber is that they are flaunting the law here in Washington, DC, it is illegal to pick up street hails
yeah.
if you're not a medallion.
Yep.
And yet they're just like, okay. And all of the congressmen who can't get taxis are with them. They're with Uber.
Are you kidding? I mean, I actually can tell you that a lot of the guys who work on the Hill, the real people who really get it done, the
right.
people who, if they started screaming, would be upset about, would cause real problems. They love Uber. And so, you know, you're in D.C. and you're seeing a revolution where the Taxi Cab Commission has said, we're gonna tow one Uber cab to prove a point. And what they got was an enormous amount of political pushback going, yeah, okay, point proven, shut up. and you know, and what's happening is, again, you're seeing technology overwhelm an old industry model of how we're going to do business and change it drastically and take customers' perceptions, which is taxis suck, and turn it into this is awesome. I have to say, I mean, could the Uber app be better? Yes. And I think what's interesting is if Uber sits on its laurels for too long, somebody's going to come along and pass them. But mm-hmm. that means that just having a cab fleet and having drivers isn't cutting it anymore now. You better have the software to back it up or, well, yeah, I hope you're not planning on making a lot of money.
Right. I would have disagreed with you. I would have said, no, you've got political power, which is that they give people with medallions an effective oligopoly. But no, this Uber is proving it because right. it's so useful that it's even going against the political power,
yeah,
the original political power.
I don't see a lot of Uber in New York. What's their... I understand that it's kind of this mobile app model where you kind of call for a taxi in the nearest one.
Yeah, you right. call for a taxi. Perhaps. It shows where they are on a map.
Yep. Except they're not taxis. They're basically what they're doing is they're renting out town cars. The model here in D.C. is the town cars that are sitting there with 3 hours between job A and job B that have some free time can use the system and basically say, I'm available on their iPhone, and then somebody from an iPhone can hail them as a taxi. The great part is when you get hailed, they show up on your doorstep, they hit their iPhone button that says, I got my fare, put their flag down, take you where you're going, hit the button that says, we're done, and all the payment and everything else is automatically handled behind the scenes.
Yeah, like, there's no cash, there's no stiffing you.
Yeah, exactly. Everything's handled. In fact, there's no tip.
Yeah, there's no rate.
Right,
there's no rate adjustment. Like in New York, there's two buttons. There's an in-town rate and an out-of-town rate.
Right. There's no rate adjustment.
They can hit it by mistake.
Right. So there's no rate adjustment. There's no – I mean, the computer on the back end decides what the fare is that's going to get paid to the driver. And so it basically is avoiding the drivers, you know, either accidentally or on purpose making a mistake.
But right.
more importantly
– human error.
It's very transparent. You get an email with a map of the exact route you took with a price breakdown with exactly how much you paid and why you paid it and every little detail – perfectly expensible, and I think it's brilliant. And by the way, not a dime changes hands. So, I don't have any money on me. Where's the ATM? I don't need an ATM. I'll just call the car, and here it comes, and I'm done. You know, that's you know, I've been wondering why cabs can't do this for a long time, and now I'm starting to wonder if cabs can survive if they don't do this. So,
yeah, Jim's been wondering if they can't do that at Starbucks.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I think that you should be able to order from your phone,
yep.
and that will automatically print out a sticker at that.
Starbucks.
They'll put it on a cup. They'll make it for you, and at the end of the line, they'll scan the sticker, and it will tell your phone that your drink is ready, and it will pay for it automatically through your phone.
Yeah, and I think that this is, you know, I think that's brilliant. I mean, if another coffee company, and there are competitors out there, came up with that and started pushing that idea forward, Starbucks might find itself fighting back.
Perhaps Caribou here in D.C.
Right here in D.C. Or, you know, there's the tea and coffee company that I saw in Las Vegas that does a great job. Somebody will come up with that and people will go, hey, that's even better. And now even the trouble is even bigger.
Yeah, no waiting in line.
Exactly. Or even better, in these big buildings downtown, you know, like five or six people order a coffee and the guy like basically, you know, you're like, oh, I want one of those. And the next thing you know, this guy's walking into your office going, here's your coffee, and walks away.
Exactly. I'm surprised there's not coffee delivery in New York City. Everything else gets delivered.
I mean, the Starbucks is in your basement. How hard can it be? And the only problem is they're like, well, how's the payment method work?
Well, I have a mobile phone. I have a credit card.
Right? Yeah, I know. What's the problem? But this is, I mean, you know, I'm always hit. I'm hit by – eventually this will happen even in grocery stores. I mean, I live across the street from a Whole Foods, but mm-hmm. I wonder if at one point you're not going to be able to basically punch in a list of all these things I want from a grocery store and walk in and basically like your basket will be identified by a number. You'll grab it and you're done. Like you mm-hmm. walk out. I mean, they already have talked about automatic checkout systems and stuff, but I don't even mind somebody checking me out. It's the wandering through the store trying to figure out where my crap is. Mm-hmm. They take care of that for me, and you better believe I'll come back. And you know what? That store will get my business more often. And, you know, especially if you're a suburban person who can drive up you know, basically have them drop the cars right into your, you know, you paid for it, everything's dropped right into your car, you basically take off and you're done. You know, the grocery store would love that model because it's guaranteeing they're selling more groceries and they're drawing more business, and you just save 30 minutes of time. There's 1,000 places where mobility is going to change the way we do things, and that's just in the consumer market. The business market, we see so many holes where I look at what companies do and say, why are you doing this? And the answer is because there's a mobile opening right there. It's just sitting there.
Yep.
It's so frustrating as a developer to see how close we are to some of these things. It's like, it's right there. It's like you have everything you need. Starbucks is a great example in that they have a great app for managing their gift cards and paying by scanning the QR code on your phone.
They just don't have the point of sale part.
They've got so much, and they're so close, and it's just that one extra, like, you've already got my credit card number. I've already got, like, a gift card registered with you. All it would take is that little label printing machine or that little notification system to my phone. It's like you're one step away. Whole Foods is the same way. I live above a Whole Foods, and they've got, you know, $6 delivery. It's like, what if I could just shop on my phone?
And then walk downstairs, pick it up, and then walk away. I mean, what's it cost you to pick up my goods? Well, probably a lot less than it cost you to have all this stuff, you know, the way it's set up now.
Unfortunately, I think we're running out of time here. Our podcast has to be limited due to technology constraints on the hosting provider.
Okay.
I don't have any final words or a pick. Did you come up with something, Ben?
No, it's been a fantastic conversation. Thanks, Jonathan.
Oh, my pleasure. Yeah,
guys. Great conversation. Great. Thanks, Jonathan. Love to have you again.
Absolutely. Take care, guys.
All right. Bye, Ben.
All right. See you guys.